What? We gardena in yr dagum theud cyninga thrymia frwnon. Hwtha athlinga zelen fremadon. Oft siwd sheifing siadden a thratum monigum maethum medo setla oftec. Ig so de erla sith an erest werth. Fias shaft funden hithas fro freya beild. Welks under welcome, werth mundum tha, oth at him I will chum setendra, over ron rada, huran shoulda, gomban guldan. That was God kinning.
That, if the patient work of philologists for the past 200 years is any guide, is how Beowulf may have sounded over 1,000 years ago, when it was sung to an Anglo-Saxon audience. Of course, no one actually knows the tune of Beowulf. There was no music left from Beowulf, and we don't even know if the manuscript was ever intended to be sung or recited, or if it was just for private reading. But we're fairly certain that Beowulf represents part of a major tradition of Anglo-Saxon culture. Beowulf the poem dates from no earlier than 1015, and possibly as early as 700. We don't really know, and in fact, I've seen Anglo-Saxonists almost come to blows over arguments of the date of the poem. The poem is found in a manuscript, exactly one manuscript, only one, and that manuscript dates from right around the year 1000. It was copied sometime between 975 and 1025. But the poem itself may be much older. It seems to refer to ancient events in the north. It seems to have very close connections with Scandinavia, as well as with England. And of course, the language of Old English is connected to German also. In trying to explain this amazingly interesting and enigmatic poem and the artifact of the manuscript and the entire huge edifice of Beowulf studies that has grown up around it, it's important to go back to what we actually do know. And what we do know is that we have a piece of parchment that dates from around the 10th century, that we almost lost. The Beowulf manuscript was copied down in a monastery sometime in the 10th century, and then we have no idea what happened to it for hundreds of years afterwards. Sometime during the dissolution of the monasteries, when Henry VIII confiscated all the property of the English monasteries, or later during the Protestant Reformation, someone came across this manuscript, and it ended up in the hands of a man named Lawrence Nowell. How do we know this? Because Nowell scribbled his name on the front of the manuscript, and it's often called the Nowell Codex because of that. Years later, in the 18th century, a man named Sir Robert Cotton got a hold of the Beowulf manuscript. He was a collector of ancient manuscripts, and he set them up in his library in a very interesting system. He had bookcases all over the library, and on top of each bookcase, he had a bust of a Roman emperor, so there'd be a head of some Roman emperor on each bookcase. And so each bookcase was labeled Vitellius A15. So you'd have the bookcase for Vitellius, and you'd have the shelf A and the 15th manuscript over, and that would be where Beowulf was. And Beowulf is actually called, its official shelf mark is Cotton Vitellius A15. So again, the first shelf, the 15th book in the bookcase under the head of Vitellius. Well, in 1731, Cotton's library was held in the aptly named Ashburnham House. And in October 1731, it caught on fire. Beowulf was almost destroyed. The edges of the manuscript were fairly badly burned, and as far as we know, it was saved by being thrown out of a window by people who were rushing through the library and gathering up as many manuscripts as they could. This burning along the edges of the manuscript caused us to lose a great many letters. And this has made understanding Beowulf very difficult, since we've lost many letters and many parts of words. After the Cotton Fire, Beowulf was neglected for a long time. No one could read it. No one spoke Old English. And so the manuscript was just ignored until, in the 18th century, Humphrey Wanley was going around cataloging all the ancient manuscripts. He couldn't really read Beowulf. He thought it was about pirates or something, but he at least wrote down that there was this manuscript, Beowulf. And then later on, Scandinavian scholars became interested because they thought it might be about ancient Scandinavia, about the history of Denmark, perhaps, and they began to study it. Finally, in 1815, a Danish scholar named Grim Johnson Thorkelin published the first edition of Beowulf. But this was also fraught with problems as well. Thorkelin went to England, and he copied out the entire manuscript on his own. And he also paid a scribe to copy out the entire manuscript. So we have two transcriptions, Thorkelin A and Thorkelin B. Now, these transcriptions are very valuable because they preserve letters that have since been lost. Because even though the manuscript wasn't burned again, the edges of the manuscript kept flaking off and being destroyed. So Thorkelin A and Thorkelin B preserve information about a lot of lost letters. But there's a problem. Thorkelin A doesn't agree with Thorkelin B. And neither transcription perfectly agrees with what we have in the manuscript. So we have errors, but we don't know which one is the error, whether it's Thorkelin A or Thorkelin B, and there's all kinds of arguments about which one might be right. Then poor Mr. Thorkelin goes back to Copenhagen and spends years compiling this first edition of Beowulf. And then the English and Denmark go to war. England bombards Copenhagen and burns down Thorkelin's house and destroys his edition. And he has to start over again. His notes and his transcripts are saved, but his actual edition was burned up. So this is like the curse of Beowulf. If you work on Beowulf, your house will burn down, your manuscript will be destroyed. And that's what happened to poor Mr. Thorkelin. But in 1815, he brings out the Editio Princeps, the first edition of Beowulf, and people start to study it. It nevertheless took a great many years before people actually understood it. And here's kind of the big thematic problem with Beowulf. In postmodernism, you hear a lot about the indeterminacy of the text. Well, in Beowulf, that's really the case. It actually has holes in it. It actually has burned edges with lost material. When the British Library finally protected the manuscript, they put a paper frame around all the edges to keep them from charring off. This has worked very well, but it also covered up a whole bunch more letters that we now try to get by shining fiber optic lights behind the manuscript and other techniques. The point is, then, that we don't really have a perfect Beowulf. What we have is a manuscript that a bunch of scholars have come and made educated guesses and tried to come up with intelligent explanations of why things might work. They use philology, they use science, they use linguistics, and they try to figure out what's in Beowulf. But in the end, you really have to figure out what the poem means as an individual scholar or as an individual student by deciding which proposed change you might believe in. For example, there's an evil queen mentioned in Beowulf. Now, it may be that this evil queen's name is Modthrith, but it also might mean that there is some kind of strife of mind, which is what Modthrith means, that has to do with this evil queen. If you look at the manuscript, there's a big space between Mod and Thrith. On the other hand, other proper names have big spaces between them. There are other similar problems. At the very beginning of the story, we hear about Beowulf, king of the Scyldings. But here's the problem. That's not our Beowulf. That's not the Beowulf that the whole rest of the poem is about. And everybody gets confused. Now, people think that the scribe was perhaps told, well, you're writing a poem about Beowulf. He comes to this name, Beo. He thinks it's an abbreviation for Beowulf, and he spells out all of Beowulf. That's a lot of special pleading. But it confuses the heck out of everyone that there might be two Beowulfs in this poem, because they don't seem to have anything to do with each other. You can see what the problems are. And just as we have our two transcripts, Thorkelin A and Thorkelin B, we also have two scribes of the Beowulf poem. One scribe writes from 1 to 1949. The other writes from 1949 to the end of the poem, which is 1382. But then the second scribe goes back and corrects the first scribe. The second scribe is an older handwriting. It's an older person. So the older person wrote the second half of the poem and then went back and fixed the first half of the poem. No one understands what this means. Some scholars think that means the second scribe is the actual poet. But if he's the actual poet, why did he have someone else write the first half of his poem? Nobody really knows. And it's these mysteries that make Beowulf so exciting to work on. As you notice from my singing at the beginning of the poem, Beowulf is not in any English that you can understand, except for perhaps the line, Thought was God kunning. Yes, Beowulf is in fact in Old English. This is the language that was spoken before 1066, and there's a reason that it's so different from ours. When the ancestors of the Anglo-Saxons migrated to England from Northern Europe, from Germany, they spoke a language that was very close to German. This is Anglo-Saxon. This is the language of Beowulf. That was the language of England for about 500 years. Then in 1066, a French prince, William of Normandy, conquered England, became known as William the Conqueror, and made French the official language of England. This was the official language of England for about 150 years or so. That doesn't mean that people didn't continue to speak Anglo-Saxon. The French didn't exterminate all the English. They just put their language on top. When England and Normandy finally split again into two kingdoms, Anglo-Saxon goes back to being the major language, but it's no longer Anglo-Saxon. It's been modified, it's been changed, it's become what's called Middle English. It's what Chaucer spoke. And then, around 1500, Middle English changes to Modern English in something that we don't really understand, called the Great Vowel Shift, when everyone started pronouncing their vowels differently over about a generation. So that's why Beowulf is different from what we speak today. But it is recognizably akin to our language. You can see a phrase like "that was god kunning" and know that it means "that was a good king." And that's really one of the major themes of Beowulf. What is a good king? It's a poem about kings and princes and the elite people of their society. And it's also a poem about monsters. And this is perhaps what Beowulf is most famous for. The story of Beowulf can really be seen as two parts. And within those two parts, three monster fights. The first part of the poem is Beowulf going to Denmark to find a monster which is terrorizing the court of King Hrothgar. The monster's name is Grendel, and Beowulf comes and says, "I'm going to kill Grendel or I'm going to die." Actually, he just says, "I'm going to kill Grendel," but everyone assumes that it means he's going to die. He fights Grendel, rips his arm off, and they hang the arm from the top of the hall. Everyone's happy. There's a big party. Everyone's thrilled. "You're great, Beowulf." And then that night, another monster comes. Grendel's mother takes the arm back, kills one of Hrothgar's men, and disappears into a mere, a lake near a waterfall with sea monsters swimming in it and fire on the water and all kinds of scary things. The next day, Hrothgar says, "Oh, Beowulf, forgot to tell you, there's another monster, female monster. Can you please kill it?" Beowulf, "Sure, I'll kill that monster." He goes, swims down into the mere, fights Grendel's mother, kills her, then cuts off Grendel's head and brings it back for a celebration. That's the first half of the poem. In the second half of the poem, Beowulf is no longer an adventurer. He's become king of his people. And he's sitting in his castle, enjoying his kingship, enjoying the peace and prosperity that he's brought to his kingdom because everyone's terrified of him, when someone disturbs a fire-breathing dragon. That dragon flies up, burns down Beowulf's castle, and kills many of his people. And Beowulf decides that he's got to go fight the dragon. So he puts on his armor, gets his sword and a special iron shield, and marches off and tells his men, "You leave me alone. This is my fight. I'm going to fight the dragon just like I fought Grendel." Unfortunately, the fight doesn't go very well, and Beowulf is losing when one of his retainers decides, "I'm going to break the rules. I'm going to break Beowulf's commandment, and I'm going to go help." And this is Wiglaf, the young hero. He rushes in, and together Beowulf and Wiglaf kill the dragon, but Beowulf is bitten, and he dies from the poison. Then the poem ends with Beowulf's funeral, and his people saying, "Now we are doomed. Without Beowulf, we shall be enslaved and slaughtered." And the poem ends with the memory of Beowulf. Now, for a long time, people didn't believe that this was a very well-done poem. They thought that, oh, it's not nearly as good as the Odyssey or the Iliad. It doesn't fit. But in 1936, J.R.R. Tolkien, the author of The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, though he hadn't written them yet, gave a lecture called Beowulf, the Monsters and the Critics, in which he showed, to the satisfaction of just about everyone, that Beowulf actually did work very, very well as a poem, and that it wasn't anything to be embarrassed about because there were monsters in it. The monsters were symbolic and representational. And in fact, Beowulf was a beautiful poem about death and sorrow and loss and heroism. That's where things stand today. When we begin to study Beowulf, we think of Beowulf not as a mess that has to be cleaned up, not as a source for information about the ancient world, but we think of it as a great and powerful and beautiful work of literature. And as I hope you will see, when you hear it read in its original language, you'll see the beauty that can be there in the language itself, and it's even more beautiful when you understand what the language means. So now I give you Beowulf.